you. Anybody listen to Quantum, The Weekly, Beauty for Ashes? It's coming up. This is the man behind all of this. So, David, welcome. Thank you so much for giving your time for coming today. Maybe if I could ask you just to introduce yourself, just briefly.
I'm David. I'm from Scotland. I've been in Australia for 7 years, and I'm a Presbyterian minister now in Newcastle, the centre of the universe, where you're all going to come to university to study.
Well, welcome, and I'm sure we'll all come to Newcastle soon. first of all, thank you everyone for submitting questions. We have a box full of questions. We have gone through them. I'm not sure that we're going to get to every single question, but there were some similar questions, so we tried to group them together. We tried to sort of summarize them, so we want to get through as many questions as possible. But David, there were some personal questions, just a couple. So the first one, when did you start to follow Christ?
Can I just also say that if I just kind of think out loud, and so sometimes I shouldn't, and if you get offended at anything, can you just blame Sarah? And then if you've got any further questions, please feel free to write me, because I love being myself. The reason I like the question and answer, just thinking about things. When did I become a Christian? I'm not sure. And I'll tell you why. I grew up in a Christian home, and then when I was about 12, I said, right, that's it, I'm out of here. So any of you who are much younger, please don't do this. My mum and dad said, you have to go to church, and I said, no, you can't make me go to church, because if you do, I will make paper planes and throw them at the elders, and I will put paper pellets into ladies' hats, and I will, you know, I'll just cause trouble. And my parents gave in, and so I didn't go to church. And then when I was about 16, I went to America on a holiday with my aunt who lived in America, and she said to me, would you like to go and stay at a university? And I said, yes. But actually, what she did wasn't good. She didn't tell me it was a Christian university, and that there'd be a camp, and there'd be 10,000 Christians at it. And I was raging, because I couldn't be an atheist. I tried to be an atheist, and I tried to be a communist, and none of that worked. So I just thought, but I was so angry, I spent my whole time in the camp arguing with people. But there were six Arab Christians there who really blew my mind, because I thought these guys are for real. So I thought Christians were either stupid or hypocritical. And I thought, no, these guys are for real. And so when I left, I thought, right, I'm going to read the Bible. When I go home, I'm going to read the Bible. But I don't do what I'm told. So they said, start at the Gospel of John. So I started at 1 Kings. And I used to read, I used to share. I lived in my dad was a farm worker. We lived in a farm cottage. I shared a room with my three brothers. And I used to read the Bible at night with a torch and with a bed. And to be honest, they thought I was looking at pornography. And I guess, you know, some people would be considered that. And I struggled through 1 Kings. You know, I couldn't get anywhere with it, really. Anyway, it came to Christmas and New Year. And one of my friends, who wasn't a Christian, between Christmas and New Year, we went to parties all the time. And one of my friends, I phoned up and said, which party are we going to tonight? And he actually said this to me. He said, God is good. And my first reaction was, this is unfair, because he doesn't come from a Christian home. He's obviously become a Christian. Why is he a Christian? Why am I not? And I said, what happened to you? And he said, can we go to a church meeting tonight? And we did. And I remember praying, getting very confused. And it was New Year's Eve, actually. And the clock went to 0:00, and I remember praying at that exact moment, God, if you exist, you show me, and I'll serve you the rest of my life. And nothing particularly happened. I came out at midnight in Scotland, and it was like 0 degrees, and I looked up at the stars, and there was no flash of lightning, nothing happened. For 2 weeks, nothing happened. And then I said to my kid brother one Sunday morning, we're going to church. He said, no. I beat him up, because he's my kid brother. He came to church with me. This was my first evangelism. It was very effective. It's a method I use ever since. No. And we got on our bikes and we cycled to church. My mother was absolutely shocked. We didn't go to their church. And I'm sitting in the church, and then the thought just hit me, you're a complete idiot. Of course God exists, because if God doesn't exist, nothing makes sense. And at that point, I knew. The gospel made sense to me. It was about, at that point, I knew it. So this young gentleman here is going to ask me a question. Go ahead. How can I beat my little brother? Come on here and I'll show you. he was my kid brother, and he was saying, I'm not coming. I'm saying, I lifted him out of the bed. I said, you're coming or your head's getting bounced off that wall. And he came with me. So it's not a method I would recommend, by the way. And you're smiling too much, looking, thinking, I could do this. No, bad advice. Don't do that. I thought I'm a Christian, but then I thought, I don't like Christians, so I'm going to be a secret Christian, like the ones in Russia, and I'm not going to tell anybody. And then, and maybe this helps you understand me, so this is why it's such a long answer, the other ones won't be so long, this is a very personal one. We were sitting in our school year room, year 10 would be, I think, the equivalent in Australia, or year 11, and there were 60 people there. Four of them got up to go to a prayer meeting. And I used to be the guy who was always laughing at them and arguing with them. And one of them turned, and it was an extraordinary thing. I don't know why he did it to this day. He turned to me and said, David, do you want to come? And everyone laughed, you know. And I got up and I said, yeah, I'll come. And I went with them. And everyone thought I was what we call taking the mickey, just having a laugh. And I went with them, and they sat in this room, and they prayed. We sat in a circle, I sat in a circle, first one prayed, next one prayed, next one prayed, next one prayed. It came to me and I thought, oh, well, I better pray too, since I'm a Christian. So I prayed, and then they tapped me on the shoulder, and they said, are you a Christian? I said, yeah. And they went, wow! What? And I said, yeah, I am. And then the first thing they said to me, Dave, do us a big favor. The Debating Society next week are having their annual Christian debate. Can you speak on behalf of Christians? I thought, oh, all right. So I did, and afterwards, the head of the English department, a teacher, came up to me and said, Robertson, my boy, that was a splendid performance. You almost had me convinced you really were a Christian. He thought I was acting. And I looked at him and I said, Mr. Patterson, I am, and no one will ever say that to me again. And from that point on, I said, I am going to be upfront and public about my faith, and I've been arguing for Jesus ever since.
What are some challenges you've faced in your life, and when did you need God the most?
That's such an interesting question. I don't know, I think I face challenges all the time. And I would argue I need God all the time, and even when I don't particularly feel that I need him, I do need him. It's like saying when you need air. You know, you need air all the time. But there are particular times. One time I nearly died. I collapsed in a pool of blood, was taken to hospital, and I was in a coma for about 8 weeks. And I wasn't expected to live. The surgeon, my surgeon, who was actually a Muslim doctor, said when I left hospital after 3 months that he'd never seen anything like it. He thought it was a miracle. And so do I, by the way. So that was a very, very dark time. People kind of say, oh look, when you nearly died, was it like you went to heaven and St. Peter was there and you got shown around and then he said, no, you've got to go back, you've got work to do. And I said, no, for me personally, it was like I went to hell. I didn't literally, but the experience was a very, very dark experience, and I had nothing but God. You know, I was, My wife tells me, because I was in and out of a coma all the time, I don't remember any of this. So I believe what they told me. My wife tells me that one time, her name's Annabelle, by the way, that one time she was there with my daughter, who was 14, and it's quite funny. The doctor said I had a 50-50 chance of living at that point, and my wife thought he's going to die, and my daughter thought, no, it's great, he's got a 50% chance of living. But my wife says that I turned to them and said, I'm in hell. And she said, no, no, you're not. You can't be in hell because, you know. And then she realized that she was talking to someone who was going through a very dark experience, and coming up with a Christian cliche really didn't help. So they didn't know what to do. So what they did, every single time they came in, there's a, I've got it actually. There's a book that's very precious to me, and it's this. It's the Book of Psalms out of the Bible. And they came in and they read a psalm to me every single day, and that helped. So I think that was probably the time which was the darkest in my life. But there have been lots of other times as well. I don't feel I'm ever in a position where I don't need God.
The last sort of more personal question. Have you ever had doubts about God?
Have I ever had doubts about God? Yes. So, when I became a Christian, I was about 16, I think. And for me, it was great. I was reading the Bible. It was all wonderful. And then someone gave me a book that said 101 problems in the Bible answered. And I had no problems with the Bible. And after I read the book, I had 101 problems. Because the problems were all real and the answers were rubbish. And I just thought, oh, have I been conned? Have I been brainwashed? You know, what am I doing? And the first thing that happened to me was I just thought, hang on a minute. You're like a tiny, tiny baby Christian. You don't have to know everything. What do you know? And I thought, well, I know that Jesus died for me. That's what I know. And that was enough. Now, since then, I've had three other times, usually all of them actually very short, but there were times of utter blindness when I thought, they're what I would call atheistical thoughts. When I thought, what if you based your life on something that just is not real? And that, emotionally, I felt that. And actually what got me out of it, to be honest, was rationally thinking about it. And also remembering the experiences. I mean, you could argue these experiences were false. But I think having doubt is not a bad thing. It's how you handle those doubts and how you deal with them. That's the most important thing. I'll put it another way. A young guy comes to me and he says, hey, how do you know who you're supposed to marry? And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I'm going out with this girl and I really like her. But what if she changes? And I said, oh, she will change. And so will you. And he says, but what if it's not going to work out? And I said, well, you want 100% certainty. He said, absolutely. How can you marry someone unless you're 100% certain? And I said, I don't trust people who are 100% certain about anything. Because you need to understand that things will change. And, you know, what you've got to do is you've got to say, can I commit myself to this person for the rest of my life? Can I do that? Will I do that? And if you do, you recognize that at times you will have doubts about your relationship, but that doesn't mean that you walk away. People who are 100% certain, and then they go into it and then discover, you know, that their husband has smelly feet or something. You know, hey, why did I ever marry him? Well, am I here? No, no, no. We doubt things, but you work them through. And I think it's the same in your relationship with God. If you can doubt things, you can say, God, where are you? And not feel his presence and really struggle. But you still come back to the Word. So that's where I say, I've gone through three periods, very short, each of them. One was only 5 minutes, one was 3 days, one was probably a week. Where I had real, real, real doubts. And all I had left was a very thin shred of faith, which said basically, no, I do believe in Jesus. And Jesus says that tiny shred of faith is more than enough, and that has been enough. So, yeah.
Good question. These are all good questions. All right, we'll move on to some of the other questions. So there were a few questions about free will, but we've picked a couple out. So
why is there evil in the world if God is reigning?
Can I say, I've got some copies of a book that I wrote for teenagers, Seek, and I thought, if you're willing to acknowledge that you asked the question, and I think it's a really good question, I'll give you one for free. Now, you need to understand that this is a really big deal, because I'm a Scotsman, and normally I would charge you a fortune for this, you know, but you're getting it for free, so just don't tell anyone, okay? Because other camps, I mean, people pay for them. And also, I did want to say that it's good to be back with you. I was here 2 years ago, and there are certain things I remember. The absolute embarrassment of talking about how you don't call someone by their pronouns, such as he, and then Mr. E here announced himself as he, and I didn't believe him. And then I had to apologize, and I discovered there are lots of he's. I'm still looking for the first her, but... I remember that. I also remember thrashing someone at chess. Who was that? Oh yeah, up at the back, yeah. That was a good one. That's all I remember, actually. I remember some of your faces. I'm very rubbish at names. So, that's given me some time to think about the free will and... What was the second part? The kind of... If God is in control, is that...
Yeah. Why is there evil if God is...
Oh, why is there evil if God is in control? Yeah, okay. Well, I struggled with this for a long, long time until about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, just before I came to Australia, so it would have been longer, with the problem of evil. Because the argument is very simple. If God is good and all-powerful, then a good God wouldn't want there to be suffering, and an all-powerful God would be able to prevent it, right? That's the argument. It's a very simple argument. But actually... life is way more complex than that. So, I would normally give an hour and a half lecture on this subject, so I better not do that. Because I do think that the existence of evil is actually a reason to believe in God, not a reason to disbelieve. Because if there's no God, how can there be no good and evil? You know, it's just all societal stuff. But you recognize that there's evil. And if there's evil, then there must be good. So I think the easiest way for me to explain it is basically two kind of stories, or maybe one. So I did a debate in the University of Cambridge, and it was about whether God existed, and this man stood up and he said, Auschwitz, that's in the Holocaust, is wrong, it's not a fact. And I interrupted him, challenged him, and I said, no, it is a fact. The fact is, it was wrong that 6 million Jews were killed. And he said to me, prove it. He said, I agree it's wrong, but you can't prove it. You can prove gravity, but you can't prove that something is morally good or evil. And I said to him, well, I can actually. And I said, you can't because you don't believe in God. And he said, well, you think you can because you do believe in God. You start off with believing in God. And I said, no, this is how I work. It's very simple for me. I had an 8-year-old daughter at that time. Anyone who rapes my daughter, that is an evil, evil, evil act. I can hardly think of a worse one. All of you here agree that that's evil, right? So let's go back. We agree it's evil. We agree there is evil. How do we go? We go one step back, and we go another step, and we go another step, and eventually we'll come to God, because God is good. And, you know, for me, that was hugely important. So you then come to the question, well, why then is there evil? If God is good, why didn't he create a world in which everything was just good? Well, he did. He did. That's what, you read Genesis 1, God saw it was good, God saw it was good, God saw it was good. So something went wrong. Okay, so why did God allow it to go wrong? Because God could have prevented it. So here's my other answer to that. If I were God, I could create a world in which you never experienced any pain, sorrow, or suffering. You never had any broken relationships. You never had any doubts. Would you want that? And most people go, yes. I said, well, I could do it by making you a chair. Because the chairs that you are sitting on do not have thoughts of existential angst. There's not one of them thinking, oh, I wish it was a couch. There's not one of them thinking, I wish somebody lighter was sitting on me. None of them are doing that. They're not worried about broken relationships with the tables. You know, they are, to them it's, they don't know good and evil. Now, if you're going to love, you've got to have the choice of being able to love or to not love. Right? So that's really important. If you're going to choose good, you have to be able to choose evil. If you can only choose good, it's not a choice. You're a robot then. You're programmed. You're AI. But you're not. You're moral beings. You can decide to do things that are good and evil. And what God did was create a world in which we could have that choice. And he had to give us that free choice. He couldn't create a world in which he said, I will give you a choice, but if you make the wrong choice, I will change that for you. So you're not really getting a choice. So, sorry, I said the question would be short. This is such a big question. I saw a play once. It was a great play. And it showed two boys walking along, and one said to the other, I've got a pet pigeon. My pigeon is called Fido, or whatever, and my pigeon loves me, watch this. And he threw his pigeon up, and the pigeon went up and perched on one of the bits of the roof. And then he called, Fido, Fido, if you love me, come back to me. And he had the pigeon on a string, and he pulled the string, and the pigeon came back to him. And his friend said, that's not fair, you're cheating. Of course he's going to come back to him. You pull him back. Cut the strings. That's when you'll really find out. Cut the strings. And that's what God did. He wanted us to freely love him. So he gave us freedom to go against him. And we did go against him. And that's how evil came into the world. So the question is not, where does evil come from? Because evil is not a thing, it's just the absence of good, it's the absence of God, it's people turning away from God, and it's what happens when people turn away from God. The question is not, where does evil come from? The question is, what can be done about evil? And that's the whole point of the cross, why Jesus came to defeat evil and everything else. So, again, who asked that question, by the way? Because that's a great question. Does anyone want to volunteer that they asked it? Because you can have this if you want. You have to be quick. No, and you can't lie, all right? No one's volunteering. Let's go next. Oh, by the way, sorry. The young gentleman there, what's your name?
Isaac.
Come on down, I want to give you one. Because you had the nerve to ask a question. Even if it was a completely daft question, I thought it was great. Thank you. That's yours. That's a simple answer. For you personally, I would say this. You need to run from and resist the sins that you're most inclined to do. Right? So, to be honest, despite what I said earlier, I'm not really inclined to violence. I don't want to go around and beat people up. But I may be inclined to overeat. I may be inclined to be proud. So you need to be aware of yourself. And there's a verse in the Bible, Peter, that says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. So we kind of need to resist all sin, but I think we need to have a degree of self-awareness which makes us realize. So let me give a great classic example. I have a friend who, he used to be a drug addict, and then he'd been clean for about 17 years. And we were visiting in a house, and he said to me, Dave, we've got to get out of here. And I said, why? He said, just get out. So we went out. And I said, why did we have to get out? And he said, the girl in there, she's lying, she's a user, she's got cannabis, and she's got heroin in the place. And how do you know that? He said, I can smell it. I know it. Believe you me, he said, I know it. And I said, why did we have to leave? He said, because I made a rule in my life, I will never, ever be in a place where there are drugs. Not a party, not a pub, nothing. Because, he said, 99 times out of 100, I'll resist it. It's the one time that I don't. So he made a rule for himself, and it was a really good rule. It's not a rule for other people. He knew himself. He knew his weakness. And that's what you have to do. You have to know yourself. You have to know your weakness. So the answer is, you resist and run away from both.
In a world where religion is seen by many as folly, how do we maintain that confidence in God? And I guess in addition to that, why is it so difficult to live practically in Christ?
Okay. I think those are actually two very different questions, so I'll deal with the first one first. In a world where people think religion is folly, how do we maintain belief in God as well? Right, here's the first part of that answer. Religion generally is folly. Religion is human beings trying to reach out to God. And there's some really crazy religious stuff, right? And there are religious people who believe really crazy things. And there are some religious people who profess to be Christians, and I go, whoa, I don't want my daughter going out with them, right? So you can understand why people would put all religion together and say, whoa, this is really dangerous. Here's the thing, how do you maintain your faith in God? The Bible warns us about that. The Bible says very little about atheism, Psalm 14, cited in Romans, but pretty well not much else. But it says a whole amount of stuff about false religion, about idolatry, about people inventing their own religion, their own personal Jesus. So I think religion is folly. I think religion does a great deal of harm in the world. And I think it's very, very, very divisive. And I think Jesus comes and kind of defeats that. You know, because he's open to everybody. And by the way, I think that almost every form of secular thought is a type of religion. It was G.K. Chesterton, the Roman Catholic writer, who said, when people cease to believe in God, it's not that they believe in nothing, it's that they believe in anything. I never thought in my life I would see people who believed in a flat earth. And I've met some. Wow, you are kidding me. And then there are other people who believe the most extraordinary things. You know, they believe that Elvis went up to the dark side of the moon in a spaceship. You know, and he's coming back to Sydney to run an ice cream shop and save the world. Well, you can get every kind of weird belief. And people believe it. We're all meant to go, I respect your belief. And I'm going, no, I don't respect your belief. It's nuts. It's crazy. I think belief in God is not tied in with all the different religions within the world or with people who despise it. I think belief in God is tied in with what God has done, with his creation. One of the reasons I couldn't be an atheist was I was up at the Blue Mountains, up at Kadumba, and this morning at 7 o'clock I was at the Three Sisters, and I thought, how can you look at that and say there's no God? It's like looking at a painting of the Mona Lisa and saying there's no artist. That doesn't make any sense. So I think the reasons for God, I think who Jesus is and what he's done, are way, way the way that we can continue with that. And I've seen, you know, I mentioned about trying to be an atheist. I've seen where it led, and it just leads to absolute disaster. What was the second question again? Why is it so difficult to live practically? Because we're in a battle. Life is difficult anyway. I mean, most of you are teenagers, right? If your school ever taught you, or your church ever taught you, that you're going to have an easy life, if they say to you, I believe I can fly, I believe I can touch the sky, and you think you can do that, I'm going to take you to the top of a 15-story building and say, do it. Well, I'm not, you should kill yourself. But life is tough. A lot of bad things happen. And in Christianity, we are never ever told, become a Christian and everything will be easy. In fact, we're almost told the opposite. We're told, I knew when I became a Christian. When I came out as a Christian, in those days, it was worse than someone coming out as gay. You know, because it was like, what? You're a Christian? And I knew it was going to be tough. And I found the Christian life tough most of the time. But In another sense, it's not, because Jesus says, take my yoke upon you, for my burden is easy, my burden is light. And what that means is, when you look at Christ, when you're with Christ, when you are part of Christ's people, it's really living. So I know it's hard, but it is possible, and you're always going to stumble and get things wrong. That's fine, but you've got brothers and sisters who come alongside you. And I would rather live as a Christian, weak as I am, than die as a non-Christian. Okay.
So how do we overcome the tendency to serve ourselves over God?
How do we overcome the tendency to serve ourselves over God? If someone is willing to own up to asking that question, before I answer it, I want to give you one of these. Anyone feel free that you want to? Did you ask that question? You did. Show yours. Oh, there you go. There you go. What's your name, by the way? Lucas. Nice to meet you. It's a really, really good question. It's an unusual question, actually, because it recognizes one thing that's really important. All of us are self-focused. Let me give you a kind of mind experiment. Could any of you do this, actually? How do you know that any other mind exists apart from your own? How do you know that? And you may say, oh, because my person, yeah, but that's just in your mind. It's like in a dream. When I was in hospital, I had lots and lots of psychotic delusions. I thought I was the king of Norway, you know? At some point, I asked the staff to get me Justin Bieber, which is really like, I must have been off my head to do that. How do we know, you know, all these different kinds of things? And because we're so focused on ourselves, the world is around ourselves. When you're a very young baby, what does the baby want? The baby wants food for itself. You'll never see a baby go, if there are twins, you'll never see a baby who's breastfeeding go, oh, no, let my twin brother have a go at it first. You know, that you wouldn't. And as you mature and grow older, you learn about sharing and so on. But we still are self-absorbed. You know, you think about yourself. I have a sore back, so I think about my sore back. I don't think about other people's. I think about my time. I think about what I want. So it's really, really hard, even when you're trying to get away from yourself, you're still thinking about yourself. So it's a really hard issue. There's a guy called Tim Keller. If you come across this book, get it. It's just one sermon, one of the most influential sermons I've ever read. It was turned into a book. It's called The Truth of Blessed Self-Forgetfulness. Now, what that means is this, that as you look to Christ, you see more of him, and yourself fades more into the background. But also as you look to Christ, you see the needs of others, and you genuinely help them. Because you see them, you know, and it's not all about you. I think it's a battle that you'll be fighting all your life. It's a battle I fight. But again, it's like the previous question. I think it's a battle that can be won. So, yeah.
Is it not incorrect for us as humans to pass judgment on others? And if so, why should Christianity condemn choices such as abortion or sexuality when ultimately it is God's place to judge?
So I like the word ultimately. Ultimately, it's God's place to judge. So only God can judge the heart. Only God can say why someone is doing something. Only God can deal with our motives. But we do, if we want to live as a community and a society, we do have to have standards that people have. It's a ridiculous example, but if I came here and said, you know, I just don't like Chinese people, I'm going to shoot half of you, right? And if I did that, you know, or anyone who's called he, stand up, you're dead. You know, that, you know, surely you would judge me for that. You have to judge me for that. It's wrong. This idea, you just let people do what you want because it's wrong to judge. No, no. Jesus did say, judge not that you be not judged. All right? But that's the most misquoted verse in the Bible. Because 4 verses later, it says, don't cast your pearls before swine. Why is he calling swine? You know, how do you determine that someone's a swine? That's judging, isn't that? I mean, in Jewish culture, that's really judging. So, I don't think I am in a position, if someone was going to be executed, let's say, like at the Bondi shooting, if these guys were going to be executed, I don't think I'm in a position to rejoice at that and to say, well, they deserve it. Because I have to look and say, you know, maybe that could have been, you know, maybe it could have, maybe in different circumstances, I could have been somebody doing that. But equally, I do have to make judgments. I have to determine things. And you do it to protect others. I had a man who came to my church once, and he wanted to be an elder, and he wanted to teach in Sunday school. And then we discovered that he was a paedophile. Would I be right just to say, well, I can't judge him? Let him be. No, not a chance. I offer him the gospel. I remember saying to him, under no circumstances will you ever be in charge of children in this church. And in fact, you must never be with children in this church. Ever. Because even though what you've done in the past, if you become a Christian, it's been forgiven. Nonetheless, we still have a responsibility to protect and care. So I think you can make judgments, but what you can do is make absolute judgments in the sense of writing people off or condemning them. I've seen some really terrible people come to church. I had a man who came up to me and said, Dave, I've just got out of prison. And I said, what for? And he said, murder. Am I welcome? I said, well, yes, you are. But that was a very interesting one. There were other situations, other people who came and confessed some pretty horrible stuff. I'm not going to say, hey, it was okay what you did. I am going to say, you are welcome to hear the gospel. And I don't sit in absolute judgment on you. There is one who will. And I want to tell you about it. So there's a balance in there. You have to have judgments. You will make judgments, but they can never be absolute ones.
As humans, sinful nature is all the same. It is only the environment that we are brought up in that can cause corruption to come to light. And how is that fair for those who have been brought up in a harsh environment and might not get a fair chance to grow in Christ and to know God before they're done?
Who asked that question, by the way, because that's also an excellent one, and it's quite unusual. There you go. It's very easy. What was your name, sorry? Jessica. Nice to meet you, Jessica. That. Do you study philosophy at university or something? No? You should do. Okay, so we're talking here about a classic sociological argument. Is it nature or nurture? Because in nature, some of you are born with certain genes. You know, like my daughter is a redhead, and we joke about redheads being more temperamental. And then she gets really angry and, so proves the point. But whether that's true or not, there are certain things that you are in terms of your genetics. They may even be bad things that you have to learn how to control. But nurture is how you're brought up. So say, for example, you are brought up in a home where your father teaches you it's okay to beat women, then you're probably going to grow up thinking that's okay. On the other hand, if you're brought up in a home where the only time my father ever hit me was when I once hit my mother, and he said, you'd never, ever hit a woman. And it was a lesson I never forgot. So my environment really helped me with that. So the question has a really good premise, because your environment is really important. But the Bible goes deeper than that, because the Bible suggests that sin is so deeply embedded that if you put a bunch of really good people in a perfect environment, they would still spoil it, because sin would still come out. So I had a friend, he's quite well known, Tim Keller, and he moved from a rural community in America into the heart of New York when it was really, really rough. And people said, how can you do that to your family? Because they bought two apartments, knocked them together, and started a church. I mean, it grew to about 5,000, but it was extraordinary what happened. But at the time, it seemed crazy. And they said to him, how can you do that? And he said something brilliant. He was always coming up with brilliant stuff. He says, the sins of the suburbs are the same as the sins of the inner city. The only difference in it is this. In Bankstown, the curtains are open. It's going to be done in the North Shore. It's going to be done behind the curtains. And what I would say is this, that sin finds a way of coming out. It is true that there are certain advantages that people have. So, for example, if you're brought up in a home with two loving parents, that gives you a massive advantage. And don't despise that. But that still doesn't mean to say that you're going to grow up and be the perfect person. So I also think when it comes to judgment, that God takes into account all of these things. And that for me is very interesting. What I found is this. Where I am in Newcastle just now, we were a church of about 20 people, 20 elderly people. I mean, Neil would be our youth group, right? So that's how bad we were. We would love Neil as our youth group, but, you know, it was just... We called it Zimmerframe Central. And people have started coming, but who are the people who are coming? I mean, there's maybe up to 100 now. Most of them fall in two groups. There are people who stopped going to church and have given up and started coming back, or there are people who've never gone to church. And of the people who've never gone to church, some of them are coming with very rough and mixed up backgrounds. And it's strange, one of the reasons they come is because they know that they are in need. And they know that they're sinners. If I go into a working class housing estate, I don't need to tell people they're sinners. They know. It's when I go into a middle class suburb, and if I say they're sinners, people get really upset. So I think there's advantages and disadvantages in both. I think the question is a really good one, which is why you got the book. But I think that God is fair and just. He will take all these things into account. But sometimes you can be in the worst of circumstances, and it's that that makes you go to Christ. Sometimes you can grow up in luxury and you think, well, why do I need Jesus? I've got everything. Well, you haven't, but you just think.
Why doesn't God save everyone since he is almighty?
I actually don't know. I would guess that one of the reasons is expressed in Romans, that he may show his justice. If he saves everyone, then it doesn't matter, does it? You're saying he has to save Hitler. You're saying he has to save, you know, I get people who are victims of horrendous things. And they find it enormously confronting. If I was to say, well, the man who attacked you, he's going to be saved anyway, whatever happens. So that doesn't seem to me to be just. So I think there's a justice involved. I do know that the Bible says that God will save a number that no one can count. And I do know that when I get to heaven, I'll be really surprised and say, what are you doing here? And they're going to look at me and say, well, I never thought you'd make it either. You know. So we don't know, but I think it is primarily to show his justice. So God has no obligation to save anyone. He could justly wipe us all out. The fact that he's chosen to save a number that no one can count is an incredible thing and a wonderful thing, and that's what the good news is. It's a good question too, though.
Does God only show himself to those who have already believed? And wouldn't it be easier to show himself so others may believe?
Who asked that question? You can get a book as well. Thank you. What's your name? Rebecca. I was going to say Angel, but that's just your shirt, isn't it? Rebecca, thank you. So again, going back to the philosophy, there's a problem with what's called the hidden God. So I met with a lady who was an atheist and an artist, and herself and her partner have got on very well, and they've even started coming to church. And she's got to a stage where she says, I wish that God was real and I could believe, but I can't believe because I can't feel or see or experience what you're talking about. And that's the idea of the hidden God. So the first part of your question is that actually, no, God does not show himself just to those who believe. So, for example, I believe I had an experience of God before I believed. I think that God shows himself in general terms. Romans 1 says that he reveals himself through the creation so that people are without excuse. So that's one way of showing himself. But I also think that sometimes people come into a context and a situation, they experience something and go, whoa, what happened? And it's not because they believed. God, in a sense, comes to them before they believe. So I think that does happen. What was the second part of the question? Yeah. Wouldn't it be easier to show himself? We see, my argument with this is God is not that hidden. I've already mentioned the creation. I do think the Word. I think God shows himself in his people. I remember one man saying to me, I was in a rural church, a village church, and he said to me, I could never come to church because it's full of hypocrites. And I said to him, well, you should come because you'd fit in very well, which probably wasn't the subtlest of answers. But then I said to him, do you know anyone who's not? And because it's a small village, everyone knew everyone. And he said this, and basically, if anyone asked anyone this question, the same answer was given. Oh, there's Ross the lorry driver. There's Donald the carpet fitter. There's Big Margaret. There's Wee Margaret. There's, you know, and they went through a list of people who lived consistent Christian lives within the community. And I would say this, that is God showing himself to people. You know, I remember one man had a big impact on me, and I only met him once. I was a student at university. I was struggling a little bit in my faith. I was thinking things are not fair. This is not good. Why is God not letting me have this, that, and the other? Especially a girl I was keen on who didn't have the good taste to realize what a gift from God I was for her. Even though I told her that, which, guys, that's not a good chat of mine, by the way. I went to this prayer meeting, and it wasn't the normal minister. It was a young man from Cambodia, and he told us of his time with Pol Pot, how he was a doctor, and he was taken to a camp, lived on a quarter of a can of rice a day for 4 years, that his family all died, and he eventually escaped and managed to get across to Australia and then came to the United Kingdom. And as I listened to him talking, and he talked about his faith in God, and I just felt, oh, you idiot. You know, God is working in different people and you don't even see it. And what that man has experienced. The most amazing thing by that, by the way, was he came back to Australia, and his sister, who he thought was dead, was here. She had also escaped. But what I'm saying is that God doesn't hide himself. We're the ones who do the hiding. Since the Garden of Eden, it was Adam and Eve who went and hid themselves. God didn't hide himself. We hide and he seeks us. I think we talk quite a lot about people who are seeking God. I much prefer to talk about the God who is seeking people. Jesus came to seek and to save that which was lost. So one of the ways I want to show people God is to show them Jesus. It's against people.
It might take a short scripture reading, but I was going to say
that you're not falling asleep, but this is tough going for you guys. So, yeah.
What is life like in heaven? I don't know. I really don't know. Most of the images in the Bible that we get about heaven are images. Maybe the easiest way to answer this is to again tell you a story. I was 16 years old. I'd just become a Christian. I went to a Bible conference in the north of Scotland. The speaker was a really great guy called Dick Dowsett, who's still alive. And at midnight, I was walking on the beach, and Dick joined me. And I said, I want to ask you a question. He said, what's that? I said, am I a bad person because I don't want to go to heaven? And he like smiled and said, why don't you want to go to heaven? I said, well, there are two reasons. The first is, it sounds like an eternal church service, and I'm going to be sitting on a cloud playing a harp for like forever, and I find an hour in church quite a stretch sometimes. So the idea of that for eternity is not exactly appealing. And then the other thing is this, look at this. The moon was setting over the sea and the mountains and the rivers. I said, I love this. I don't want to leave this for some kind of golden city. And beside which, I want to go to Barcelona, I want to go to Beijing, I want to go to Shanghai, and you know, I want to go to Sydney. And he looked at me and he laughed and he said, oh David, don't you realize that all of this is in heaven except this is just the shadowlands. Now, he was really quoting C.S. Lewis. Just think of the things that you enjoy in heaven. So I once wrote an article that kind of went viral and it was entitled, Are There Strawberries in Heaven? Because my mother and father grew the most amazing strawberries. And my answer to the thing was, yeah, everything that's good in this life is in heaven without everything that's bad. So the strawberries will taste so much better. You know, it's like, maybe I shouldn't use this. No, I'll go here anyway. You can kick me out afterwards. It's like the difference between a really bad Chinese takeaway and there's a restaurant in Chatswood I go to, which is phenomenal Chinese food. You know, and once you've tasted the phenomenal Chinese food, you don't want to go to the bad one again because you've tasted something so much better. I think heaven is what's good on this earth multiplied by a billion times. So, but I can't describe heaven to you other than that.
If God loves us so much, why did he create hell? Is that just in case we didn't love him back?
St. Augustine was once asked, why did God create hell? And his answer is the one I'm tempted to give for people who ask questions like that. Which is not fair, because it's a decent question. Revelation tells us that God made hell for the devil and his angels. He didn't make it for us. And hell is the place of darkness. It's the place of separation from God, ultimate separation. So just as I was saying, heaven is all the good on this earth multiplied a billion times with none of the bad stuff. Hell is all the bad on this earth multiplied a billion times with none of the good stuff. Because no matter how miserable things in this world could be, they could be worse. But in hell, they can't. And I think what God was doing was saying, you've got a choice. You're choosing good or you're choosing evil. If you choose evil, you get what you get what you ask for. Now, it's very clear to me that, and back to Jessica's question, God does choose people to go to heaven. I don't think he chooses people to go to hell. You may say, well, he must do. No. He's not saying, right, you know, you're going to heaven, but you're going to hell. He's saying, he's inviting people. In fact, the Bible itself says he's not willing that any should perish. So, I don't think that God created hell for us. But I think in one sense we create our own hell, and in another sense we're choosing to go to be with God or the devil. And if you choose to be with the devil, then that's hell.
So what happens to those who never get a chance to know God and his existence?
What happens to those who never get a chance to know? Well, first of all, no one never gets a chance to know. Well, hang on a minute. Let me reverse that a little bit. I think a baby in the womb who has not become conscious and dies, I've sadly buried, you know, 18-month-old babies. They go to heaven. I have no doubt about that. Because in Revelation it says, the dead are judged according to what they've done. And they've not been in a position where they where they've been able to do anything. I also think that there are people who have no, I used to work with people with severe mental handicap, and some had an acute awareness of God, which is really quite remarkable. But there may be exceptions to the general thing. Nobody is judged on what they don't know. Now, what I mean by that? You cannot be judged for rejecting the gospel of Jesus if you've never heard the gospel of Jesus. But, as I said, in Revelation, the dead are judged according to what they've done. In Romans 1, people are judged according to what they know. So, every culture, I mean, I, for a while, read Confucius, and then I looked at pre-Confucian Chinese culture, and it was fascinating to me that in pre-Confucian Chinese culture, there was always a belief in the one creator, the one great creator. It's the same in indigenous culture in this country. It's the same in African cultures and elsewhere. So I think that human beings are given a certain amount of knowledge, which is internal. God's law is written on their hearts, and it's external in what he has made, and people are judged according to what they have done with that. I think the gospel comes to people to tell them it's never going to be enough, and the ship is sinking, and we brought along a rescue boat. So I don't think it's just a case of it's not fair because people don't know and therefore they shouldn't be judged on what they don't know. Well, I think God would agree with that. I think it's made very clear people are judged according to what they've done. Give one example. I think that I will come under greater judgment if I turn away from God and Christ and the Bible, because I know so much more than the person who's never heard. And I think there are degrees of judgment, and I would be coming from one of the worst if I did. So, yeah.
Okay, this is the last one we sort of separated out. Do pets go to heaven?
Do pets go to heaven? Only if they're human ones. No. I mean, I call my dog a pet. No. Hi, pet. How are you? So, as I say, when I was 16, I became a Christian. I was part of this small prayer group. And we began to reach out to our schoolmates, and some of them started becoming Christians. And I did have a girlfriend, and me and my girlfriend had a massive buster over this question, because she believed pets went to heaven. And I believe they didn't. So she got rid of me. She dumped me over this question, do pets go to heaven? So this is a triggering question for me. Entirely traumatizing. No. The answer is no. Will there be animals in heaven? I suspect yes. But pets do not have souls in the way that we do. They do not have conscious rationality. I grew up on a farm. And you see, the trouble with the world we've got today is people think of animals like their own listening, where pigs talk. You know, no, they don't. My dad was a pigman. I have never seen cows having a prayer meeting. You know, and sheep don't go around wondering what the point of being a sheep is. Animals just get on with what they do, and they can be very loving, and they can. But you can't hold animals morally good, can you? I mean, or morally evil. We shouldn't judge animals the way that we would judge a human being. I had a dog that was a rescue dog. We rescued it. Tess, we loved Tess. I never got another dog after Tess. The trouble was that Tess escaped a couple of times and she started worrying sheep. And worrying sheep means ripping their throats out and killing them. So we had to have Chip Tess put down. I wouldn't put any human down. But we had to do that to Tess. And I don't expect to see Tess in heaven. She's a very precious dog to me. So I don't think animals do go to heaven, but I do think there will be animals in heaven. Just individual ones in the sense of who we really like. I remember when we had two goldfish in a bowl. My kids were very, very young. And one of them was called Speedy, but he was ridiculously speedy. He was so speedy that he jumped out of the bowl and one of us stood on him. And my kids were really upset. And so we had a funeral for Speedy, you know, complete with, well, we didn't pronounce that he went to heaven, but, you know, we had the full works and buried him in the garden. As far as I know, he's still there. But no, it's the one ahead. All right. In fact, who asked that question? So I'm going to give you this, if you want to. Oh, I can't. No, I'm not giving you another one. No. In fact, yes, take it and give it to a friend. Okay. Thank you. Really good. Right, listen, does anyone here want to ask a question? Just feel free, just now. You're very, very welcome. And no question is too daft. Go for it. How does free will fit in with God's plan for everyone? God's plan includes free will. He chooses to give us free will. So he gave Adam and Eve free will. Did God know that they would reject him? I think yes, because it talks about Christ. In Ephesians it says that Christ was chosen himself before the creation of the world to come into the world and die for us. So I think God did know, but his knowing that doesn't take away their free will. And it's the same with a lot of stuff that we do. I would say we have a free will, but it's not like Adam and Eve's. It's a bit more limited because we're more limited by our nature. So if I take my grandkids, so I've got 2 grandkids in the Blue Mountains, for some reason they associate me with ice cream. If I gave them a choice between broccoli and ice cream, they've got a choice, but I know what they're going to choose, you know, because I know what their nature is. And I think that's the same with God. I think it fits in. I think God has chosen to give us free will within a limited sphere where we don't have absolute will. I can't choose, for example, I live in Newcastle and say, I can't bother driving on the Pacific Highway. I'm just going to teleport myself to Newcastle. I can't choose to do that. It's impossible. You know, so yeah, it's a good question. Yes, go up here. I'm going to give you this.
Well, you're going to run around, okay? That's good.
For people that lived before Christ came to earth, how is it fair that they never got to know Christ so that they all go to hell?
Daniel. Daniel's a really good question. So your namesake Daniel knew about Christ. And Abraham knew about Christ. And Moses knew about Christ. Because in Hebrews it says that he regarded his grace for the sake of Christ. So what's really happening, if you want to understand the Bible, Christ, if you like, is in the middle. The people after Christ obviously hear about him. But there were people before Christ who heard about him. Job said, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end he will stand on the earth. And how I long to see him. I'm just going through the book of Judges, and the angel of the Lord comes to visit Samson's parents, and this is in my preaching, and Samson's father, Manoah, says, we've seen God, we've seen, and I think the angel of the Lord is Jesus. So I actually think people before Christ did know something about Christ, and enough for them to have faith. So the example of faith that Paul gives in Romans is of Abraham. So there's some. Now, your question becomes much more difficult when we say, well, what about those who never heard of the Lord? You know, what about others? And that comes back to the earlier question about we're judged according to what we know, not what we don't know. And I would be very careful. There are things that we just don't know the answer to. All I know is that Jesus came for everyone. Yeah, so it's a really good question, Daniel. Thank you. Who else? So a couple other.
There's a gentleman there and a lady there. European, but you will get a chance. There it goes.
On behalf of one of the youth, if the world was made in 6 days, what happened to the dinosaurs?
Doesn't necessarily follow that if the world was made in 6 days, anything should happen to the dinosaurs. You know, so to put it simply, there are some people who believe that the world was made in 6 literal 24-hour days. There's a difficulty with that because the sun wasn't created until the 4th. And it's, you know, they're solar things. There are those who think that the days reflect periods of time. But neither of that makes any difference with the dinosaurs. We know that the dinosaurs were here. Personally, I believe they were here a long time ago, and that they became extinct. Because we've got dinosaur bones and everything else. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that was God trying to trick us to see if we had faith. So, yeah. To be honest, I'm not like most of my grandchildren. I couldn't care to who's with dinosaurs. Unless I was in Jurassic Park.
In the Bible, there's like mentions of like evil spirits and demon possessions and sorcery. How come none of that happens today?
So you're basically saying none of it happens today? How come none of it happens today?
I think it does happen today. I think the demons are still around. However, in the Bible, it's very interesting that there are three periods in the Bible where there are periods of miracles and periods of strong demonic activity. I would argue that anyway. One is Moses, one is Elijah and Elisha, and the other is Jesus and the apostles. And I think at the time of Jesus and the apostles, the demons recognized who Jesus was, and so there was a stirred up activity. I think we have to be very careful talking about demonic possession, because there were, I had a guy come to me once and said, "Dave, I think I've got a demon of laziness." And I said, "No, you're just lazy." But I have been involved in situations where somebody has had a strength that was beyond them, where I thought, whoa, there's something hellish about this. I personally wouldn't go anywhere near a seance or a Ouija board or anything like that, because I think that's opening you up to demonic forces. And I've been in places where there was just something that was very, very, very dark, and then we discovered afterwards there were centers for witchcraft. So I think you have to be very careful in all of this, but I would not dismiss, I think, demons are basically angels who've gone mad. They still exist, they're still in the world, just as there are angels, real angels, who serve God. So, yeah.
Okay.
Do you agree with the statement that any freedom is acceptable as long as it doesn't take away the freedom of others?
Okay. Do I agree with the statement any freedom is acceptable
as long as it doesn't destroy the freedom of others? No. Or yes. Yes, if that were possible. No, it's not possible. So, for example, someone may say, well, I'm free to look at pornography. How is that destroying the freedom of others? Well, first of all, it's destroying the freedom of the women you will meet in your future life who you've come to regard as objects. Secondly, what about those who produce the pornography and who have to demean themselves to satisfy your desires? And there's a whole industry going on with that. So I cannot conceive of anything which does not impact upon others that we do. So the poet John Donne, no man is an island. We're not. We're all connected. So that's one thing. That's a general answer. I think the more specific question is, within society, should people be free to do things that are wrong? And I would say, yes, they should be, to some degree. So for example, I believe that people should be free to choose their own religion, that the state shouldn't ban, you know, Islam, though I think it's a false religion, or shouldn't ban the cults, though I think they're harmful. I think people have to be free to choose. But I would always argue that there is nothing that we do that does not impact others. You know, it always does. It impacts who we are, and therefore it impacts the impact we have on others. There's more to that question, so thank you for it. It's a really good one.
We know that Jesus died on the cross, but I just want to ask, did it have to be a cross?
No. We use, there are some who want to argue it wasn't even a cross. What we do know, what it had to be, was a tree. Cursed is anyone who dies on the tree. Now, because the Romans used crosses as a way of executing people, I think Jesus could have been crucified on a stake. If you like, he could have died on the stake. So I don't think it actually had to be a cross. But I think for the fulfillment of prophecy, it definitely had to be a tree, and a cross fulfilled that. And at that time, it was the most humiliating way to die. You know, it was a horrible, horrible death. The astonishing thing is, Jesus should have been 3 days on that cross, because that's how long it normally took people to die. But he died within 6 hours.
How does like God's army win against demons if angels turn is like bad angels turn into demons? So like if God's army like all turn evil, like how does he beat the demon?
Sorry, what was your name again?
Isaac.
Okay, yeah, listen. There's a certain theme to your questions. So, you and I are going to get together and we're going to write a book about violence and demons and war and everything else. It's a good, look, it's a really good question. It's kind of answered in the book of Daniel and also in Revelation and by Jesus himself when it talks about there being war in heaven. I don't know if that means literal heaven or just between, the angels and the demons. What I will say is this: the devil is the second most powerful being in the universe. And when Christians go around and say, I can fight the devil, I can defeat the devil, I would say, whoa, back off. Even Paul, when he was faced with a demonic woman, didn't want anything to do with it because he knew the battle that was involved. But what I would say is this: in Colossians, Paul says, Christ made a spectacle of the principles and powers by triumphing over them or defeating them through the cross. So all the demons have been defeated through the cross. So that goes back to this one. So the answer to your question, how does that happen, is simply because Christ defeated them on the cross, took away their power, took away their power over death, took away their power to condemn. It says in the Bible that the angels, the good angels, marveled at this, and we should marvel at it too. Good question.
In your opinion, if God made space infinite, why did he make it infinite if we're the only living thing in like one universe?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you mean space infinite. Now, the question of what we mean by space being infinite, that's a really interesting one. Because we also talk about space expanding. Well, how can it expand if it's already infinite? So there's a real problem there. And I actually don't think that space is infinite. I think that God created everything. I do think he created everything through a big bang. I think at some point you would get to the outer limits of space. But I like what Job says, that he gazes at the faraway stars and realizes these are but the outer, inner fringe rather of his works. There's so much more. I think the space question used to really, really bother me, because I would look at the stars and think, man, we are so tiny. We're this tiny planet. And then you realize, whoa, but God made this planet so that human beings could live on it. I personally doubt that there's life on other planets. It might be, I don't know. The Bible doesn't say one way or the other. But I'm not convinced that space is infinite. I think it expands, so I can't understand how it would be infinite if it's expanding. So, yeah, that's a heavy question. Thank you. Anyone else?
This is a bit poorly timed because my question was sort of similar to the last one, but how do you personally bridge the gap between science and religion, seeing as they're both seen as the truth, however, can be highly contradictory at moments?
So, I wish I had a book to give you, because I always get questions about science and religion, and there's two or three of them, I think, in the seat book. I've never found a problem, personally, between science and religion, or, let me put it this way, between science and Christianity. Because the way that the Puritans did this, they said, God has given us two books. He's given us the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture. And the Book of Nature is what we would call, we can examine by science, right? And so I think it is impossible to do science unless you accept certain things. First of all, you have to accept that the laws of nature are universal and that they're the same now as they were in the past. In other words, you couldn't do science, and you couldn't do science if you thought there were lots of different universes and different gods and different laws everywhere, because it wouldn't apply. So you've got to have a universal set of laws. If you have that, you've got to ask who made those laws. So it's similar to the artist argument. I think the problem comes when you move away from science, which science is a methodology, right? Science is how you examine something and you prove it. Normally you would put forward a thesis or a hypothesis. Someone would put forward an antithesis. You come up with a synthesis. You keep going. Science is always trying to prove itself wrong. You know, and as a methodology, I think lots of religious people, Muslims included, but lots of Christians have been involved in it. I just don't really see any problem with it. I do see a problem with the philosophy of scientism, but that's a philosophy. It's not science. And it's a philosophy which says that the only things that exist are things that can be proven materially or through science. But there are lots of things that cannot be proven through science. So there's a guy called John Lennox. Look up any of his books. But A Science Buried God is probably the one that you should get. And he makes the point of this. He says, when you boil a kettle, the scientist can tell you at what temperature water boils, can tell you how electricity works, but the scientist cannot tell you why you boiled the kettle. Because you boiled it to make a cup of tea for your granny because she likes you making tea for her. You know. So science basically answers, it's a simplicity. Science basically answers how questions, but can't answer why questions. So science can tell you how to split the atom. It cannot tell you whether you should make a nuclear bomb or set up a nuclear power station to provide energy for you. Again, that's one of the big questions. All right. I think we're just about done. I think that you have been absolutely brilliant. It is at a conference this afternoon slot. We call it the graveyard slot because it's where speakers come to die and where you come to sleep. As far as I'm aware, none of you have fallen asleep. I'll leave you with two things. One is a story about falling asleep. A young man who was very confident in his own ability to preach, and he went to a church where the minister said to him, there are two old men who will sit at the front and they will fall asleep during your sermon. Don't worry about it. They do it all the time during mine. That's just the way they are. And he said, they'll not fall asleep during mine. And when he preached loudly and slammed the desk and everything. But both of the men fell asleep. And he shouted louder and he slammed the desk louder. They were still sleeping. And then one of them woke up. And the young man pointed at him and said, hey, you, wake your friend up. And the old man looked at him, he was sharp with attack, and he said, no, you wake him up yourself. It was you that put him to sleep. So I'm glad none of you have been put to sleep. And the other thing I want to say is this. One of the most interesting stories about Jesus' life. And the fascinating thing about Jesus is we know so little about so much of his life. He's born. We don't know what happened to his father. His father is dead by the time he begins his ministry. We don't know what happened to Joseph. We don't know what his teenage years were like. We know very little about Jesus up until age 30. But we do know this. Age 12, he went to the temple with his parents, and then his parents were on the way home, and they were a day away, and they realized, hang on, we've left Jesus behind, which is just a nightmare. So they went back, and they found him in the temple, and what was he doing? He was asking questions of the religious teachers in the temple. And I would say one of the most important things you can do at your age is to ask questions. I hope people will keep on asking them. But you should ask questions. And the church encourages you to do that. Your church does anyway. A lot of churches don't. But I would encourage you to do that. And I'm very, very grateful to be allowed to be here with you. I'm sorry about the Scottish accent. But I'm sure you survived. And thank you for being so kind.